Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chicago's a great city, but it does know its gun battles. 54 shootings in a single weekend last month. Now the nation's battle over guns, gun control, gun rights is centered on the city as well. A Supreme Court decision in June wiped out a 28-year handgun ban in Chicago. Now the city is responding with a sweeping new law, toughest in the nation. This hour on Point, Chicago and the nation's battle over guns. You can join the conversation. What do you think of the Supreme Court's new path on guns, gun rights? What do you think of Chicago's response? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Chicago is Alex Keefe. He's a reporter for WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio. Alex, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So, first of all, what did you have before the court's decision last month in Chicago?
Well, what we had for 28 years here was a handgun ban in the city. This was something that was enacted in 1982. Basically, it made it – you had to register guns with the city of Chicago, but you weren't allowed to register a handgun. So effectively, we had a ban. This was in effect basically until yesterday when Chicago passed, as you said, and the billboard is one of the toughest gun laws in the country now.
Just to be clear, in those 28 years of a handgun ban, there was nothing like, perfect peace on the streets of Chicago. You've had plenty of gun murders.
Yes, exactly. And this has been one of the debates around this issue is how effective is this handgun ban really? There have been a few studies on whether gun bans really work, and they're rather inconclusive, but they're certainly not a panacea. Obviously, as you mentioned, it's not unusual to wake up on a Monday morning, especially in the warm months in Chicago, and unfortunately find that there have been literally dozens, if not scores, of shootings over a 48 or 72-hour period. Chicago holds gun turn-ins all the time. People can sort of turn in their guns for a gift card or something like that, no questions asked. And these bring in thousands of guns, not just handguns. We see assault weapons. We see a lot of different things. So I don't think people were under the illusion that this was fixing the problem entirely, but it was certainly symbolic of the city's stance toward gun violence, which has been a big problem here, as you mentioned.
And whatever someone the position there, as soon as the Supreme Court acted, Chicago has said, we're not going to stand for losing the ban. We're going to do something new here. As you say, came into effect yesterday. What's in the new ordinance, Alex? What are the outlines of this toughest in the nation gun law now?
Well, I'm not familiar with all gun laws in the country, so the city has been saying that this is the toughest in the country, and I could definitely safely say it's among the toughest. The city council was sort of waiting in the wings. They anticipated that the ban was probably going to be overturned. Things that we're dealing with now, of course, you need a state permit in order to get a gun. Adults must register their gun with the city, and if you're under 21, so between 18 and 21, you need parental permission. You have to take 5 hours of training on the classroom and in the range in order to get a city permit, but you have to do that outside the city of Chicago because the new ordinance also prohibits gun shops and firing ranges within city limits. Once you get your handgun, you could only keep it in your home. You can't walk out to your garage if someone's trying to steal your car. You can't go on your front porch. The city is very clear about restricting this to the home. You can only have one ready-to-fire gun at a time, no more than one handgun a month. I mean, basically, city lawmakers have quietly told me that the idea here is to make getting a gun in Chicago as difficult as is legally possible.
Now, you can have more guns in the house, just not loaded and ready to fire. They can be in a gun locker, packed away, not ready to go.
That's correct. The idea is, and this was something that was challenged in the Supreme Court case when D.C.'s gun ban was overturned. Here in Chicago, you're allowed to have one operable gun in the house at a time for the purposes of self-defense. This is what the D.C. case in 2008 decided the Second Amendment protected. Mm-hmm. However, if you have other guns in the house, they have to be either taken apart or they have to have a trigger lock or something like that.
And there's already challenges to the law in Chicago, the new ordinance in Chicago? Challenges
yes,
coming?
We- Yes, we do. Well, already we already have a couple of federal lawsuits filed. One group of residents is challenging the age requirements and these restrictions on where you can keep a gun, you know, just in the home. And there's another group of firearm retailers that are challenging this prohibition on the sale of guns within the city.
It didn't take the mayor of Chicago long to respond to the Supreme Court decision in McDonald versus Chicago. That was June 28th. Made it clear that the 28-year gun ban there would end. Here's Chicago Mayor Daley vowing to keep fighting gun violence with tough regulation.
As a city, we must continue to stand up to the gun and drug thugs who only want to terrorize our communities and harm our people.
And it didn't take gun rights advocates long to say that the new law was not the way to go. Here's Don Moran of the Illinois State Rifle Association saying Chicago's new laws in response to the ruling would be aimed at the wrong people, law-abiding citizens instead of criminals.
The gangbangers that are standing on a street corner that are having the shootouts, they're not going to go pay $500 to register a firearm. They're not going to sit through a training class. They're not going to do it. Nothing is going to change for them.
Alex, what's the conversation in Chicago now? I mean, all through this period, while this is being managed and the change is being put through, I guess it was unanimous in the city council there, killings have gone on, gun killings have gone on.
Sure. It wasn't technically a unanimous vote. It was unopposed. It was 45-0, but some people weren't there.
Okay.
But the conversation largely, I think there's sort of a disconnect between the two sides. I think for a lot of people who are gun rights advocates, they see this as a constitutional issue. This is about fundamental rights. This is about the Bill of Rights in 1791. Whereas, you know, people here in Chicago, a lot of city lawmakers are seeing this as a real rubber hits the road public policy issue. I mean, they're faced with these headlines, you know, many times a week about people getting killed, and they say, well, we want to ban this not as a constitutional issue, but as something that is just going to keep people safe on the streets. But the arguments that you proposed that you played in the sound bites a second ago are very much how people are talking right now. The gun rights people say, you know, this ordinance is only hurting law-abiding citizens who can use these guns to defend themselves and deter would-be burglars or muggers or things like that. And other people on the other side say, well, basically any way to keep guns out of Chicago is a good thing.
Alex Keefe with WBEZ Chicago Public Radio. Alex, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with us now from Chicago, Lou Ransom. He is executive editor of the Chicago Defender, one of the nation's leading African-American newspapers, founded in 1905. Lou Ransom, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Give us some perspective, first of all, simply on gun violence in your city. The numbers that come out are really eye-popping. 54 shootings in one weekend not long ago, 10 deaths among them. Did the ban have any positive effect? Will the new ordinance have a positive effect?
That's the fallacy of the whole thing is that there are numbers on both sides where you look at it and you say, okay, you've had a ban for 28 years. Murders are down since, say, 1992, mm-hmm. you know, but there's an uptick this year over last year, and nobody seems to have a handle on that. There's the argument that, well, yeah, if not for the gun ban, there would be even more murders. But we do have more murders since last year, and there is a gun ban. So the idea that these new ordinances will keep the public safe, there are no numbers to support that. The idea that the gun ban, in the original gun ban, kept the public safe, the numbers seem to argue a little bit against that also. So we seem to be treading water here at the same time that we have these horrific numbers coming out of Chicago.
Lou, what about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas? He made a kind of racial argument in comments that he wrote related to this decision. He quoted Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist back in the 19th century, saying the black man has never had the right either to keep or bear arms, and until he does, the work of the abolitionists was not finished. Is this something that works for the black community?
Probably not. It's an interesting argument. It's actually an argument I made a few years ago in a column I wrote about this issue in the Second Amendment, because it wasn't extended to African Americans. It wasn't extended. There were some states, Virginia, for instance, that had laws that said that black people couldn't own dogs because they mm-hmm. might sick their dogs on people. You know, so you have those kinds of that kind of history. It's odd that Clarence Thomas would be arguing it, but Chicago is also the city where the NRA came in and stood up against the city, saying that when the city tried to issue a ban against public housing residents owning firearms. And they came in and argued against that. So this has been a battleground over the years. Unfortunately, like I said, none of that seems to have stopped any of the really, really senseless killing.
Thomas went on to write, when the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups proliferated, the use of firearms for self-defense was often the only way black citizens could protect themselves against mob violence. But most of the 500 or so per year deaths by gun in Chicago are African Americans these days.
African Americans, Hispanic Americans, it is a safety issue of color in Chicago, but it's not just in Chicago. It's all over the country. I moved here from Pittsburgh a few years ago, and we were keeping track of the murders in Pittsburgh, and it was 80% of the murders were involved African Americans, probably 90% of those were African American males, and the numbers carry true here in Chicago also.
But as you write in the Chicago Defender, not just Chicago. I mean, whether it's Oakland or you know North Carolina killing in a nursing home, or out in Washington State, five kids and the shooter all gone. It's not only Chicago struggling with this, but Chicago has really hewed to the ban idea. Do you think that worked at all for Chicago, Lou?
I don't think it worked from the standpoint of making people safe. And it certainly doesn't – there's two parts of safety. There's the actual safety part of it where you're worried where somebody doesn't shoot you. But there's also that perception. And if you don't feel safe walking the streets, if you don't feel safe in your home, if you don't feel safe that you can walk out of your home, mm-hmm. That's part of that terrorism that comes with the guns being there. So
Lou, hold the thought right there if you'd be good enough. We've got to take a short break here. Lou Ransom joins us from Chicago, the Chicago Defender. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Chicago's gun control story after the Supreme Court's overturning of the city's 28-year ban on handguns. Lou Ransom is with us from the Chicago Defender, executive editor there in Chicago. We'll hear some pro and con argument from scholars on this in just a moment. Lou, we've got a lot of callers already. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia. Michael, you're on the air.
Tom, how you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Michael?
Just see the ban is kind of worthless for anybody who's actually a law-abiding citizen. I grew up in Chicago, saw the violence as a kid growing up, but you know, those guys who are going to get guns are going to go out and get guns. If you're going to actually go register, carry, take a class, you're not going to be that person that's out on the street committing these 54 shootings on the weekend. It's not you. It just doesn't happen. I carry right now, concealed carry. I have a Texas concealed carry, and that's just what I do. But I'm not that guy that's going to walk in or even these domestic violence things that are going on.
But Michael, if there were no law against it, if it was just, you know, go out Texas style, get the gun, carry, do you think things might not be even worse in Chicago?
Probably in the neighborhood happening in, there's nothing you can do about that. Some individuals are going to do what they do. It's just for that person who just might happen to travel through that neighborhood for some unsuspecting reason and get caught up in a situation they don't want to be in. As I was telling, saying earlier, it's better to have and not need than to need and not have. And that's just one of those ways that me and a lot of my friends who do carry look at it.
Michael in Augusta, son of Chicago, I appreciate your call. Lou Ransom, how about it? What if it went, you know, the other way to Texas style open carry?
We had an incident here, a very unfortunate incident here in Chicago, where a young man walked up to an armed police officer outside of a police station, got into an altercation with him, took his gun and shot him and killed him.
This is yesterday or the day before?
It was a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have an armed police officer with a gun. Certainly knowledgeable about the use of a gun, knowledgeable about the responsibility of a gun, and somebody walked up to him and took the gun and killed him with his gun.
What do you take from that?
I fear that with more guns in public that more of that kind of thing would happen. It's the gun that kills you. You know, I hear the argument that, yeah, it's good for self-defense, but it didn't help this police officer. And I fear that there are other people out there who would be carrying guns, who would not be as responsible, who would be just even more susceptible to that kind of thing. I don't think that a gun makes you safe.
Lou, stand by in Chicago if you'd be good enough. I want to welcome in also from the University of Chicago, Adam Samaha, professor of law there. He helped the city of Chicago prepare oral arguments in the Supreme Court case McDonald versus Chicago that overturned state and local rights to have exactly Chicago-style controls. Professor Samaha, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
We're also joined from Los Angeles by Eugene Volokh. He's law professor at UCLA, founder, co-author of the widely read Volokh Conspiracy blog. Professor Volokh, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Samaha, first to you, do you think this new Chicago ordinance will stand? It's got a lot of restrictions built into it. Chicago says it's built tightly around what the Supreme Court now allows.
I think much of the ordinance is going to be fine, and judges will uphold quite a bit of it. But some parts of it, or at least some applications or some conceivable applications of the ordinance, are going to raise some plausible constitutional challenges. So, for example, the ordinance restricts the ability to have a handgun just to your home, essentially just to that structure.
Not even the yard or the porch or the garage.
Right. And now part of that, there's a valid public safety justification for. You wouldn't want people, I don't think, parading around in their yards with weaponry and terrorizing the community in that way. On the other hand, if you really did need a firearm for self-defense in your garage, that's going to raise a constitutional problem if the city happens to enforce the ordinance in that situation. Now, whether or not that's ever going to happen is a little bit speculative, and getting a plaintiff who could actually make that claim in court might be a little tricky. So there are certain applications where there might be some problems, but in general, the basic idea of having people register their weapons, mm-hmm. having people get permits and training before they have weapons, keeping weapons out of the hands of people who have committed violent crimes, these sorts of restrictions, I think, are going to be upheld. So it's more some particular applications or conceivable applications that would raise plausible objections.
Eugene Volokh in California, what about the ban on gun dealers in the city of Chicago? No gun dealers under this ordinance. No selling of guns in the city. What about that?
Yeah, I'm inclined to say that would probably be struck down. I also suspect that the limits on 18 to 20-year-olds' possessions of guns will be struck down as well, although that's a harder call. The fact is that if you have a right to own a gun, you mm-hmm. have to have a right to get a gun.
So they say go somewhere else and buy it. You can buy it, just don't buy it here.
Fair enough. But Chicago is a pretty big city. Going out of town is doable, but it's not just like going down the block. But more importantly, what one city can do, other cities can do too. If the Chicago ban is constitutional, then the similar ban would be constitutional if it were imposed by a neighboring city and the neighboring city outside that and the neighboring city outside that. Imagine that Chicago decided to ban abortion clinics in the city. I think courts would pretty clearly say, well, that's unconstitutional because if you have the right to have an abortion, you have the right to have a place to get an abortion. On top of that, it seems hard to justify this kind of ban on gun dealers as a public safety measure. If indeed you can just go out of town, then it won't diminish accessibility of guns to criminals. If anything, it actually makes the gun dealers harder for Chicago to regulate. That if the gun dealers are in Chicago and most mm-hmm. Chicagoans go to the gun dealers, then Chicago could monitor it. What's more, just from the perspective of a judge looking at it, it sounds like an attempt to harass law-abiding gun owners for very little. And I think that's going to be struck down. As I mentioned also, the 18 to 20-year-old restriction, that's not just Chicago, that's Illinois. Chicago's importing mm-hmm. Illinois law there. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty striking. If you're 20 years old, you need your parents' permission to exercise a constitutional right. If your parent is dead, too bad for you. If your parent is a felon and therefore not allowed to grant permission, too bad for you. But if your neighbor who's 20 has a living non-felon parent with whom he's on good terms and he comes and says, Mommy, Mommy, pretty please, then he is allowed to buy it.
He's got so one and you don't. Lou Ransom, I want to hear you on that, Lou, in Chicago, but let me get a caller here first. James Peabody, Massachusetts. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to relay a story of my father. He's retired, living in the Chicago suburbs. He's been kind of passing his mornings by reading all the newspaper articles related to gun violence. He's actually been comparing the two columns of one in which a gun will actually protect an individual and the other column for those who have been either murdered or suicides or somebody who's been killed by gun violence.
Okay.
To make it more interesting, he actually weights it by he waits to keep count until he finds an instance in which a gun helped protect an individual, starts the count. He's gone up to basically 100 and only found two incidences, even starting with the protection incident, two incidences overall which the gun has been used to protect the individual, whereas the other 98 roughly are either suicides of people being killed or home invasions where the gun didn't protect them.
That's some pretty amazing, like, off-the-kitchen table research he's doing there. What do you take from it, James?
Yeah, well, for me, it's just kind of like, you know, the idea of the government turning tyrannical. I'm really actually more concerned about being killed from my neighbor than I am my government turning tyrannical. That's basically what I think.
And you've got your dad finding a sort of 2 out of 100 cases where you might protect yourself, and that specifically in Chicago. James, thanks very much for that. Lou, I'll bring that to you as well. One more first. Trucker Joseph on Route Interstate 91. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty well. What do you see, Joseph?
Well, I'm kind of agree with some of your callers there, and that the gun bans, what they do is they hinder the honest citizens from getting guns, and it don't really affect the criminals and these gangbangers because they're not going the legal route anyway. I think that we should have other ways to deter these people from having guns, make certain zone areas. Whereas it's illegal to just stand and do nothing all day. We have zones for our businesses to attract customers and give them cheaper tax rates. So we could also make zones to keep gangbangers out of there. I think that's a better way of getting the guns out of the wrong people's hands. Because we know where the guns are at. We got to address that.
Joseph, I appreciate your call. Lou Ransom in Chicago, let's go to that first. I mean, would a no loitering ordinance be more effective than gun control here? And how do you think? Is there a way by law, by ordinance, to get a handle on this?
Well, it really comes down to more effective policing. You can have a loitering ordinance, but if nobody actually enforces it, it doesn't really matter. We have a curfew for 17-year-olds here in the city, and sometimes it's enforced and sometimes it's not. So it really comes down to that level of enforcement, that if the police argue that they don't have enough police officers to do those kinds of things, it would just be adding something else that they don't have enough people to do. What strikes me is that I know today in the application of the actual ordinance, today the superintendent of police is having a press conference to kind of answer some of those questions, because there are some questions. I mean, if you can only, the ordinance says you can have one gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay.
One ready-to-go gun, more in a box.
One ready-to-go gun. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, the ordinance says that you can't take it outside your home, but you have to have training. So I'm trying to figure out how you carry the gun to get training without taking it outside of your house. So there are some application problems here that hopefully he'll answer today, but I still think that, as your other guests are saying, that there are going to be some constitutional challenges, and it's going to be a little bit sticky in terms of the actual application of it.
Adam, somehow, what about it? You hear our caller saying, gangbangers aren't going to follow these rules. Lou Ransom's painting a picture where you've got to take a gun, get to the suburbs, do your gun range training there. But how do you even take it out of the house? I mean, it sounds like just the kind of regulation that a criminal certainly is not going to follow.
Yeah, it's a fair concern. A couple of points on that. First, in terms of anti-loitering ordinances or anti-gang loitering ordinances, it turns out, to borrow Eugene's phrase, we in Chicago have to ask pretty please the U.S. Supreme Court if we can enact those sorts of ordinances. The U.S. Supreme Court actually knocked down a gang loitering ordinance in Chicago. We do have a substitute now, so police officers can issue dispersal orders to people who are loitering related to gangs. But in terms of gun control ordinances in general and where the burdens fall, I think we want to not make the perfect the enemy of the good or the better. I think everyone understands that gun control is no panacea, doesn't solve every problem. The question is whether it can do enough good in light of the cost it imposes on law-abiding people who are fairly safe to operate firearms. That's what you have to ask, and there's some evidence that it can do some good. I should also note that the claim from informed gun control people is not that gun control can reduce crime overall, but that it can hopefully reduce the deadliness or the intensity of the violence that results. So it's not that we're going to have lower crime rates with gun control. Even gun control proponents shouldn't really think that. It's more whether the crime can be a little less deadly. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, has allowed regulators to try to make judgments about who will be a responsible gun owner and what kinds of weaponry is safe and not safe. So machine guns, I don't think the courts are going to have any problem with us outlawing those. And they're not going to have a problem with more or less a felon in possession or a violent criminal ban on possession. I think that'll be okay. There will be some intermediate issues, and Eugene has raised one of those. That's, for example, the gun sale ban in Chicago. Now, in the end, I think this is a fairly low-stakes issue, because if Chicago can't outright ban gun sales or gun shops, then they'll just end up being heavily zoned, heavily regulated, and taxed, sort of like some other industries in the city. And the ban itself doesn't eliminate availability. In fact, the plaintiffs in the first round of lawsuits themselves are gun owners. They one has a farm outside the city, another travels outside the city. They have guns outside the city, and they've been able to purchase them. So I think in the end, that's a relatively low-stakes question. But there is a legitimate concern. We want all of our gun regulation, in fact, all of our regulation in general, to be able to sort between people who are generally responsible and those who are not.
Eugene Volokh in California, what about the court's decision that's coming into play here? I mean, the court itself talked about the right to bear arms as an individual right, but then it says, you know, in the home. So is Chicago tailoring this when it says not in the garage, not in the yard, not on the porch? Is Chicago tailoring this to the court's own in the home edict?
It's not clear from the court's decisions to what extent the right to bear arms extends outside the home. At times, the court stresses that the ordinances at issue in D.C. and in Chicago were broad enough even to ban gun possession in the home. But at other times, it describes bearing the right to bear arms, including the right to carry arms. And also, it says that the government may, of course, restrict the carrying into sensitive places, such as government buildings and schools. But that suggests that carrying outside of sensitive places, for example, in your car or in the street, might be constitutionally protected so long as it's not concealed, because there's a tradition of concealed carry ban. So it's an interesting question how that's going to be resolved. Hard to tell. One thing I should stress, just to correct the record with regard to one thing the one caller said, the comparison of guns being used defensively versus guns being used criminally, the difference is that a defensive gun use will often not make the news. And will often not make the news because it won't make even the police reports. Imagine that you are a Chicago resident, otherwise law-abiding, but you happen to have an illegal handgun.
Yeah.
Somebody tries to break into your house. You scare them off with a gun. The overwhelming majority of defensive gun users do not involve anybody being killed or even wounded, the attacker being killed or even wounded. So you use the gun
to show the peace.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Are you going to call the police and say, oh, yes, you know, this burglar, whom I can't even identify, tried to break into the house, and I scared him off with his gun, which I own illegally. Or even if you own the gun legally, you might still be worried that you don't want to get the police attention. What if you made a mistake on some point? And even if you do report, it may not make its way into the final police report, may not make its way in the news. So that's the wrong comparison.
Lou, let me ask you about that. We've got James's dad in Chicago suburbs, you know, sitting at the kitchen table with all the clippings spread out. I mean, these people are really clearly concerned about this. But he sees 2 out of 100 in defense. What do you say? Eugene says there may be many more that just don't make the news.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the idea that if you just point your gun at somebody and make them stop, well, that doesn't make the news. You probably don't even fire the gun. So it doesn't make the news. And so those won't get into the newspaper. The ones that get into the newspaper are the ones where somebody fired a gun and somebody was hurt. Newspapers aren't usually used to reporting stories where nobody gets hurt, nobody got shot, nobody did anything.
Lou, stand by if you would. Short break right here. Adam Samaha, Eugene Volokh, it's great to have all of you with us. We're looking at Chicago's gun control story and the country's, really, after the Supreme Court ruling last month I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Chicago's gun control story after the Supreme Court's overturning of the city's 28-year ban on handguns. Lou Ransom is with us, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, joining us from the Windy City. Also from Chicago, Professor Adam Samaha. He teaches law at the University of Chicago. He was involved in the McDonald versus Chicago case that went right to the Supreme Court. And from UCLA and Los Angeles, Eugene Volokh is here, professor of law at UCLA. Let's go to Tennessee, Cookeville, Tennessee, and Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, something that just amazes me is in the Second Amendment, where it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, in Chicago, I mean, the murder rate there, I mean, if they didn't have guns, I mean, some young kid was beat to death last year with a 4x4.
Yeah.
They bashed his brains in. So, I mean, there's certain groups in the population that it doesn't matter if it was a gun, a ball bat, a knife. You know, I've been around guns since I was, first time I ever shot a gun, I was 6 years old. My grandfather taught me how to shoot it was just a .22 pistol. And I learned to respect guns to understand what they are. And people, there's people that just don't have respect for the law. They don't have no respect for this country, period.
But surely a gun makes it easier than anything else. Easier with a gun than with a 2x4.
But what I'm saying, Tom, it yep. doesn't matter. If people are going to kill somebody, they're going to kill you no matter with what it is. I mean, banning guns is not going to do it. And as far as the deal of the guy at the newspaper going through it,
yep.
the news media does not report the people that have been saved by having guns to protect themselves. That doesn't make the newspaper.
Jerry, we've got that perspective, and let me take it right to Lou Ransom. He lives with this in Chicago, and Lou, you hear it. Jerry's talking about populations and circumstances and respect for a gun. I mean, what would you do if you were king of Chicago, Lou? How would you handle this?
Well, there would be some kind of ban, but I don't know exactly what would meet Supreme Court muster at this point, but you would have to have some kind of restrictions. Frankly, my idea is really just to have people be a little bit more responsible with gun ownership, and
a little bit.
A little bit. I mean, the folks who are not going to be responsible are not going to be responsible. We had an incident here in Chicago where there were two friends who were playing in a card game. They were women, and mm-hmm. they were not young women. They were in their 40s. They were playing in a card game. One of the players in the game said the other person was cheating. She got up, walked into her bedroom, came back with a gun and shot the other woman in the head, and then shot her two more times just to mm-hmm. make sure. Mm-hmm. You know,
sounds like Wild West stuff,
right? We have incidents of people taking firearms to their family reunions. Now, I'm thinking if you're taking a firearm to your family reunion, that's really not a good family. You know, you say, but it's the firearm. It is not. The ease in which a firearm can take a life. If we're talking about somebody being beaten to death with a 4x4, well, it actually takes a little while to do that. It takes a little while to stab somebody. It takes, but with a firearm, you can do it from across the street. You don't even have to be, you know, in their face. And that's one of the dangers of that. Now, all of that's protected. All of those things are part of the right to bear arms, you know, but there has to be some responsibility there, and I don't see that coming from either side in this argument.
Let's get a call from Waterloo, Iowa. Kay, you're on the air.
I believe that at age 18, we should issue all citizens of the United States a musket, a powder horn, a ramrod, and a lead ball mold. We are therefore being true right. to the writers of the Constitution, to the present Supreme Court composition, and
take it right back to the founders' own time, their own technology.
That's right.
So we'll look at that. But since that's not likely, what do you favor, Kay?
Nobody gets anything.
Period. Try it. But right. we've got how many million guns in this country? Well, Eugene Volokh in California. I mean, you're a gun rights guy. What if it were, you know, musket and powder horn? Would that fill the bill?
That's not a constitutional argument. That's a parody of a constitutional argument. It's kind of like saying, sure, you have freedom of speech or of the press, but only if you publish a newsprint on 1791-era publishing devices and you use horses in order to transport it from place to place. Everybody agrees. People who believe in original meaning of the Constitution, people who believe in evolving Constitution, everybody agrees that that's not the right way of interpreting the Constitution. At the same time, I also don't agree with the other caller, I'm having trouble with the phone. Let me just switch to another one. I also don't agree with the other caller who was arguing that, in fact, if guns weren't available, people would kill each other just as much with other weapons. You're absolutely right that guns are especially lethal, not handguns, by the way. Shotguns are more lethal than handguns, but guns are more lethal than non-firearms. The problem isn't that if guns vanished, then people would kill each other just as much with other weapons.
Stones.
The problem is, in fact, you can't disarm the criminals. You can only disarm the law-abiding. And I'll bet you in that card game that the other guest described, I will bet you that the person who used that gun had a pretty substantial criminal record as well, because the great majority of all murders are committed by people who have substantial criminal records. So I think disarming criminals is a sensible thing if you can try to do that. The difficulty is it's hard to get them to comply with the law.
And Lou Ransom,
disarming the law-abiding is a unilateral disarmament. It disarms the good guys but not the bad guys.
I hear Lou saying absolutely in Chicago. Let's get Miriam in Malden, Massachusetts. Miriam, you're on the air.
Thank you. One of the most outstanding people who have ever served on our Supreme Court, Chief Justice Warren Burger, said in 1989, one of the most misinterpreted things in our government is the interpretation of the Second Amendment. It referred to the right of each state to have its own militia, since there was no national army then. He said, but people are insisting that that it refers to the fact that any American citizen, man or woman, can have a gun of his or her choice. That is ridiculous and should not prevail.
But the Supreme Court says the opposite now, Miriam. They have affirmed an individual's right to gun ownership in the Roberts Court.
Yes, but that has to be changed again. But after this, by the way, a very conservative judge, Robert Bork, also, who is very, very conservative, I was surprised to see this, but he said, people seem to think that the Second Amendment refers to the right of people to have a gun. He said, I think it belongs to the right of a militia to have its own army, not of each individual. And the fact that this is the only country in the world that allows guns to be tossed around like this, Tom. And in our country, every day, today, there will be 80 to 88 people killed by guns, 31,000 every year by guns. In other countries where they had shootings in their schools, like Scotland and like Australia, as soon as they were cut or killed like that, they went to work quickly in their government and established laws not to allow guns to be bandied about like that.
Miriam, I appreciate your call. We've got your point. What, we've got something like 5% of the world's population, and I don't know, 35, 40, 50% of the world's civilian-owned handguns. Adam, somehow, here's a web comment from Brandy. She says, throughout Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings, conservatives couldn't talk enough about preventing judicial activism, and less than a week later, the conservative court overturned decades of legislation regarding gun control. If that's not judicial activism, I don't know what is. How do you see that, Professor Samaha, the court coming in here? Is this activism, the two rulings that we've seen here now on Washington, D.C., and the other out of Chicago on guns?
In one sense of the term, it plainly is. And if you're going to distinguish activism from passivity, as in judges using supreme law, constitutional law, to intervene in the democratic process or other policymaking processes, then that's exactly what's happening. And in a way, the worm has just turned. In the 70s and the 80s, we thought a lot about court intervention to protect, for example, abortion rights or the rights of criminal defendants, their procedural rights. And now the platform of issues has changed. changed, and so the discussion is more about things like campaign finance reform and gun rights. And so now the so-called left and the so-called right have shifted sides in a way because the court's agenda and their goals have changed. This also is consistent with a couple of other callers who are indicating a real doubt about the methods, the explanations that the five-justice majority is giving us in these gun control cases, that they can refer to history and give us clean answers on these questions. Mm. I want to raise a couple other issues about judicial review. As you say, Tom, going forward, the Supreme Court's now decided, at least if the personnel doesn't change, we've got a five-justice majority to do some judicial oversight in this area. Now, mm-hmm. I don't think that they'll be crazy about this. Judges aren't tend not to be radical, so the revolution is not going to be litigated, just like it's not going to be televised. But the question is, what kind of review will they engage in? And there are a couple of concerns we should have. One is whether or not federal judges will be able to tell the difference between gun control in rural and small-town areas and gun control in major metropolitan areas. Gun control doesn't make very much sense at all in rural and small-town areas, especially those areas where people grow up around guns, they're responsible with guns. It's not worth it. But gun sales and gun use and gun possession in metropolitan areas is a little bit different. The other concern is whether or not federal judges are going to develop an allergy to innovative gun control regulations. So if you don't think gun control policy is being made very well today, you have to have an additional concern that the courts will lean against novel regulation, whether it's ballistics firearms testing or micro stamping or insurance requirements or whatnot, mm-hmm. in favor of regulation that is simply old, even if it's not particularly effective.
Eugene Volokh, where do you see gun control going under this court? Chicago's already responding. You see how it's responding. What does that mean for the rest of the country? The court's two decisions now back-to-back, D.C. and Chicago, and gun control nationwide.
Yeah, well, we actually have a good deal of evidence with regard to that, because whatever the debates about the Second Amendment, and incidentally, I think on this, as on quite a few other things, Chief Justice Berger and Judge Bork were wrong. I think the Second Amendment does secure an individual right, but independently of that,
well, so the court says now, but it didn't say then. But yeah, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
44 state constitutions expressly secure a right to bear arms, of which at least 40, including Illinois, although Illinois is written unusually narrowly, at least 40 clearly secure an individual right to keep and bear arms in self-defense. Courts have interpreted those provisions. They have generally used them to strike down gun bans that are of very substantial magnitude and have upheld more modest gun regulations. I do think that, as I said, if you limit 20-year-olds' ability to get guns, especially based on not very rational factors, that would probably be unconstitutional because they're adults. But if you're talking, for example, about the restrictions on the number of guns you can have operational at any time in the home, I think that will be upheld. I doubt that it's going to do much good. I think there are a lot of gun laws that are bad policy, but that are going to be upheld by courts, because they're seen as not imposing that much of a burden on law-abiding gun owners. So, yes, I think that the federal courts will do pretty much what the state courts have done with regard to state constitutional right to bear arms provisions. They're going to strike down the broadest gun bans, and they're going to uphold more limited gun restrictions, even ones that I think are a bad idea. But the job of the courts is not to strike down everything that's a bad idea. It's to strike down those things that really do infringe the right.
More limited, but as in Chicago's case now, pretty sweeping even so. Let's go upstate New York, Niagara Falls. Mark, you're on the air, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm generally considered a liberal, and I don't own a gun or want to own a gun, but I'm sort of persuaded by the argument that criminals don't care what kind of laws you pass because they're criminals. And I was just wondering if there are any reliable statistics about gun assaults or death or homicides or whatever, differentiating between legally obtained guns and illegally obtained guns.
Let's see if we know, Mark. I appreciate your call there from Niagara Falls. Adam, Samaha, how about it? Do we know what percentage of gun crimes are committed with legally owned guns?
Well, the most important point here is that there isn't such a clean distinction between legally obtained and illegally obtained guns. That is, guns legally obtained end up sometimes making their way into the wrong hands. So if you attack only one part of the problem, then you're not going to solve the problem overall. So we have to have a concern, for example, and there is some empirical study on this, that guns kept in the home, even by very responsible people, are targets for burglary because it's a particularly valuable form of loot. Now, to be fair, one reason why it's a valuable form of loot is that it's heavily regulated, or in the past was even formally banned by an ordinance. But in any event, these are particularly valuable instrumentalities, especially for people who have been convicted of a felony and so under federal law aren't entitled to possess weapons. So part of the sensible gun regulation movement is about trying to impose restrictions and maybe insurance requirements or other responsibility requirements to make sure that guns that are entering the hands of people whom we trust don't end up migrating into the hands of people who use them for unlawful purposes.
And that would be great if you could do it, but how do you do it? Lou Ransom, you live this. How are you thinking about it as this thing unfolds? Is Chicago headed in a better direction? Is gun control even the issue? Maybe it's an economic issue. These are some populations under a lot of stress. You've got very high unemployment right now. I don't know. Is it something else?
Well, they call it in the community, it's called a state of emergency, and it's not just because there are guns there, but because there are lack of jobs, there are poor educational opportunities. So there are an awful lot of factors that go into whether or not crime is increasing. And actually, crime in the city is on the decrease.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the violent crime, and certainly the murders, that's up. So I don't think that there is any kind of panacea. I don't think that the gun ban on its own is going to improve the lives of Chicago citizens. I think that there has to be a better way of doing the policing. I think there has to be some better ways of making sure that people have the proper access to education. There has to be a complete plan. As quickly as City Council came up with this plan to rewrite the gun ordinance, I would have much rather seen them come up with a plan to deal with some of the other conditions that are existing in the community so that these kinds of things aren't the first thing that happens.
A lot easier to come up with a gun ordinance than it is to fix the full agenda of issues that a city like Chicago or many others may face. Lou Ransom, executive editor with the Chicago Defender. It's been great having you with us today. Thank you very much, and good luck there in Chicago.
Thank you.
And Adam Samaha at the University of Chicago, law professor there. Professor Samaha, thank you so much for your time and thoughts today.
You're very welcome.
Eugene Volokh at UCLA, author of the Volokh Conspiracy Blog. Thank you so much to you as well, Eugene.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. Be safe. Be law-abiding. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.